Hello and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw and I am thrilled to have a fabulous guest for a fabulous topic today. We are going to talk about buprenorphine, something that is just really on everyone's minds these days. And I have with me Dr. Tom Hickey. Tom earned his medical degree from Harvard Medical School and completed anesthesia residency at Brigham and Women's Hospital. He joined the Yale faculty in 2015, and he's a full-time staff at the West Haven VA Hospital. He's board certified in both anesthesiology and addiction medicine, and his research interests focus on the overlap between addiction and acute pain management. So he is really the perfect person to have this discussion, and I'm thrilled to have him here. Tom, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Delighted to be with you.
So I read a little bit there, but tell us a little more about you. How'd you get where you are? What does your career look like? And how'd you get interested in buprenorphine?
Yeah, great question. So I think anybody who is co-resident with me at the Brigham, shout out to the Brigham, probably knows I had kind of a natural affinity for pain management. And I always had this feeling like, well, there's got to be a better way to handle these patients with chronic pain, with chronic opioids. I feel like we just keep screwing this up every time. Like an ambulatory case becomes like a five-day painful admission. We've all been there, and there's no easy way to do it. But I think there was an inclination. And when I got to my current job at Yale and in the Connecticut VA healthcare system, and these are my views, by the way, not the government's, it was actually a case cancellation. So something we all live through if we've been in practice over, say, a decade or so. And it was a case cancellation because a patient who's on buprenorphine for opioid use disorder, so most of us think Suboxone, which is the buprenorphine-naloxone combination product. And the guy had woken up that day, like every day, taking his 16 or 24 milligrams of buprenorphine and came in for his elective hip surgery, which he looked forward to for months, probably. A lot of planning went into it. And the anesthesiologist, very reasonably at the time, said, sorry, sir, really can't do it because we're too dang nervous about your pain management. So that was then, right? This is probably about 8 years ago. And that was, by the way, what we learned at the Brigham when I graduated in 2015. It was just the best practice. And more background on that later, I think. I'm sure we'll get into it. But at that point, the surgeon said to me, listen, Tom, like, I don't care what we do with this drug, but what we're doing ain't working, right? It just ain't working for anybody. So I partnered with an addiction psychiatrist. And honestly, I don't even know if I knew there was such a thing as addiction psychiatrists at the time. And together we partnered and developed a perioperative management strategy to try to really formalize our approach to these patients. So that got me interested in addiction medicine. And lo and behold, there was this pathway to addiction medicine through the ABPM practice pathway. And you just have to justify you practice addiction medicine. And I would put it to the anesthesia audience, every day you think about a careful anesthetic plan for your patient, really you're practicing some addiction medicine. And the more I learned about buprenorphine in particular, the more interested I became. In particular, getting to know what I think is largely forgotten literature for acute pain management. I thought, man, it was a good option in the 70s, good option in the 80s, good option in the 90s, and it's a good option in 2026. So that's kind of the story, Jed.
Very cool. Yeah. And I'll tell you, I think, so my sister-in-law, shout out Judy, runs an addiction medicine fellowship. And, it's really just a fascinating field and incredibly applicable these days. And she gets applicants from all different fields. And so if folks are interested, I think that's a really neat thing to think about as a way to take your career. So let's talk about buprenorphine specifically. Give me a little background on it. Tell me about the drug. Where did it come from? Obviously, it's been around a while, but I think it's maybe entering people's minds in a way it hasn't before. What makes it unique?
That's a great question, too. And I would recommend to the readers, ask Google right now for a speech that a British chemist gave. His name's John Lewis. So Dr. Lewis, he gave it before the College on Problems of Drug Dependence. And he called it, Jed, In Pursuit of the Holy Grail. So I know people out there like Hickey's a homer for buprenorphine. I'm not the only crazy one out there if that's the case. This guy, John Lewis, and his colleagues, they were tasked in the 60s with trying to find an opioid. And actually, at the time, it was to find an opioid that would replace an over-the-counter aspirin coating product, which is weird to think about an over-the-counter opioid. But that's what they were tasked to do. And that team of chemists thought, well, we know opioids are enormously complicated. There's a bazillion downstream effects, most of which are bad, right? Unless you're treating like diarrhea or tachypnea, they're bad. Basically, we just want the analgesia and nothing else, basically. So they thought, well, we know there's this full partial dichotomy in people's mind about opioids. They said, well, why don't we try to find the one that's the most full for analgesia and the most partial for everything else? And I think in buprenorphine, they felt like they found that. Not perfect by any means, but that's what they thought. And that's what their testing, of course, then in animals really bore out. More on tests in humans to come. Now, what was it about buprenorphine, I think, that made it so? a really fascinating pharmacology. So I promise you, Jed, this will be quick and clinically focused so the readers don't, the listeners don't put me on 2X and start like unloading the dishwasher. but basically, there's some aspects in which it's very fascinating. Highly lipophilic, more so than anything you or I give on a day-to-day basis, fentanyl, methadone, it's more lipophilic, which I think results in it getting into the brain, getting into the spinal cord quickly. We all learn that in pharmacology. A rapid onset, even when you give it under the tongue or against the cheek, it has a very rapid onset. So that's one thing. A very high affinity, second only to sufentanyl when commonly used opioids are tested, affinity for the mu receptor. That aspect, together with a long dwell time, which is kind of a niche pharmacologic aspect or topic I don't think many of us learn about, but those two things together give it a long duration of action. So for opioid use disorder, we're talking days. For analgesia, like 8-9 hours, which I think better matches pain relief to pain. And that's something certainly fentanyl doesn't do, even though we use that like water. Me too. I'm guilty of that as well. So the next topic gets kind of to the safety. So I think there's two key things. One is this intrinsic efficacy, which is usually described as low to intermediate. What does that mean to most people? That means it's partial. So that has contributed to this historical classification as a partial agonist, as opposed to the so-called full agonist we always use. We always reach for morphine, hydromorphone, fentanyl. So that's one thing. The other is this biased agonist profile, which I admit to the listeners is kind of a nerdy niche topic as well. But basically, you get more of the good, less of the bad. More of the good, less of the bad. More of the G-protein coupled response, less of the beta arrestin response. So more analgesia and less tolerance and receptor internalization, GI up. And respiratory ill effects. So those two things, the partial agonist and the biased agonist profile, lend to its safety. And we'll talk more about that. I'm sure we talk about respiratory depression in particular. The other thing I think the listeners might be waiting for is me to talk about kappa and delta antagonism. It's a thing. I don't know. I can't sit here and, you know, put a flag in the ground about how important they are in our clinical day-to-day, as well as pharmacologically active metabolites. So in that respect, like we learn about methadone and how methadone has these multimodal aspects, buprenorphine you could say the same about. If nothing else, it's kind of cool to think about. Hepatic metabolism via P450 system, safe in renal failure, it's one aspect that's maybe in the ICU world might be especially advantageous. And then I think the last thing I'll say on sort of this pharmacologic background is that the government looked at it and said, this is a Schedule 3 drug. Okay, what's that mean? Well, it means they thought that it's moderate to low risk of physiologic and psychological and physical dependence. And one other thing that, and I get a blank stare sometimes from anesthesia people because, you know, I think we sometimes say God gave people veins so we could put drugs in them, right? We're IV people. It's the way we think. It's what we do. But there's a lot of formulations that I think are really advantageous, especially when you get a patient beyond the PACU, even in the PACU for that matter, where really best practices are to avoid IV opioids. So there's transdermal. Some people may have seen more and more of their patients on transdermal and buccal formulations. These would be for chronic pain management where they have a labeled indication. Sublingual, which is ubiquitous for opioid use disorder. Also long-acting injectables for opioid use disorder. This would be Sublocade, the monthly, and Brixadi, which has variable dosing intervals. I even was reading some papers from Japan and discovered there's a rectal suppository. Who knew? Yeah, interesting. So I would just suggest to the audience that these formulations provide some interesting flexibility, opportunities to study. It may have been since our intern year, which we contemplated a sublingual drug like NTG or something like that. But I'm telling you, it's not hard. Once you do the buccal once, you may become a believer.
Okay, very interesting. And any NMDA receptor effect or no?
Not that I'm aware of. I think when people talk about, say, anti-hyperalgesic effects, they usually kind of wave their hands and talk about kappa and delta antagonism.
Okay.
But the more you learn about this drug, the less it seems that you know. So I wouldn't rule it out entirely. But yeah, that's like a methadone, right? You think NMDA antagonism, maybe some sodium channel action. And yeah.
Right. Okay. Very interesting. So you mentioned safety before, and obviously one thing we think about ubiquitously when we think about opiates is respiratory depression. And I think that people think about buprenorphine as having a ceiling, of, in other words, not causing as much respiratory depression as other opioids like fentanyl, Dilaudid. What do we know about that? Is it safer?
I think so. I think what we know is that there is that ceiling effect, and I'll describe some studies. I would just put some table stakes out there, which is that we continue to use a lot of opioids in our patients despite really valiant efforts, I think, by us, by surgeons, by nursing, to really reduce their use. So we've done a good job at that, but still we reach for opioids. Buprenorphine, as I'll describe, has important safety advantages, but still an opioid, still should be treated like an opioid. It's not a cure-all. You should think about CDC prescribing guidelines, lowest effective dose, least amount of time, and all that stuff that we've been beaten over the head with for good reason, and always multimodal analgesia. But I think in this way, we could think buprenorphine as a harm reduction. So why do I say that? Bottom line up front, it's relatively hard compared to what we're reaching for every day to harm our patients with buprenorphine. Respiratory depression would be the first. Abuse potential would be the second. So from a respiratory depression point of view, it's out there. It's almost always out there in combination. When it's really a harm to patients, it's out there in combination with another CNS depressant, benzos being the most notable. If you look at studies involving respiratory depression as a primary outcome, buprenorphine really shines. It's very impressive. So the one that's usually looked at first is by Dehan. He's published a lot on this, 2006, and it was a double-blind placebo-controlled trial where basically volunteers got fentanyl. No surprise to anybody. Above like 3 mics per kilo, they get it unstable. And then apneic. I mean, they're getting a sternal rub saying, Jed, you know, deep breath. Buprenorphine, on the other hand, I would say you can imagine the graph. The fentanyl goes to the x-axis. The buprenorphine goes to about 50%. That's what they found. Increasing doses of buprenorphine by about 2 to 4 mic per kilo. And that's where the ceiling effect concept comes in. And this is a good ceiling effect. A couple other studies worth mentioning that look at the different formulations. So Webster et al. 2020, they recruit volunteers who had experience with opioids but were deemed non-opioid dependent by a negative urine tox and a naloxone challenge. And then they slug them with increasing doses of the Bucco formulation, up to 900 mics. So the maximum available dose. And guess what? Indistinguishable from placebo. Okay.
For respiratory depression.
For respiratory depression. Exactly. Wow. So again, primary outcome, when respiratory outcomes are the primary outcome. Now, similar study design, an oldie but a goodie. Lead author was Walsh, 1994. Up to 32 milligrams. And again, same population, non-opioid dependent volunteers. That's a mega dose. Even in the fentanyl era, 32 milligrams of buprenorphine is a heavy dose. And these guys, guess what? Their respiratory depression, their breaths per minute decreased by 4.
Wow.
4 breaths per minute. I mean, a 32 milligram sublingual dose. That's pretty impressive. Now, this is an experimental study. There's not all the variability of the OR and polypharmacy and blowing off the SIVO and everything else. There's one other worth mention, and it gets to the protective effect we could see in buprenorphine. And this is by Moss et al. It's kind of a ballsy study, I think, 2022, where they basically did background buprenorphine infusions in patients. They got an opioid tolerant group, an opioid naive group. They give them background buprenorphine infusions, and then they slug them with doses of fentanyl, big doses. Meanwhile, there's placebo infusions, up to like 800 mics or so of fentanyl. 50% reduction in fentanyl-induced respiratory depression in the bup group. So you can imagine a scenario where you get that buprenorphine on board a patient. You can look at it kind of as a foundational opioid, and the other ones on top of it, maybe you see less respiratory depression. I'm theorizing that because these are, of course, experimental studies. We just don't know.
Wow.
The next big category, abuse potential. So you can absolutely find non-prescription use of buprenorphine. It's certainly a thing, but it seems comparatively less compared to these other usual opioids, as well as heroin, fentanyl. A large study, lead author was Bach, 2016 to 2020, found only 1% of 1,600 persons who were surveyed used buprenorphine in a non-prescription way. So I think it's comparatively less. And I think that's reinforced by some early studies that looked at this positive-negative reinforcement, something I think was at your cousin, or who'd you say was the program director?
My sister-in-law, yeah.
Sister-in-law. So it's kind of the jargon that we learn, but maybe we forget. Like the addiction starts with the positive reinforcement. It's there to some extent. People can recognize it's an opioid. There's some euphoria, but less. But I think where it shines and what really drives the disasters of addiction is the negative stuff. Keeps you coming, results in the compulsive use and the craving, the bad stuff, the horrible withdrawal. And that's much milder with buprenorphine. So it makes sense that there'd be less of this non-prescription use. Now, just kind of rounding out the topic, there is the possibility that you'd need big doses of naloxone. So if you're going to a situation where you have to treat buprenorphine-induced respiratory depression, grab a ton of naloxone vials. It's not going to be one. It might be 10. So 2 to 4 milligrams, an experimental study by Van Dorp et al, to reverse buprenorphine-induced respiratory depression. But I would hasten to add, they were treating a 40% reduction in minute ventilation.
I mean, so it will work. It just takes a lot more.
It takes a lot more. And in that particular case, 40% reduction in minute ventilation, probably, you know, Dr. Wolpaw is not treating that in PACU or in your ICU. But it's an experimental study, and it provided that useful information that you got to go to the mattresses with naloxone if you're really worried about it.
And then, Tom, let me ask you about that, because so let's say that you reverse it. I would imagine the half-life of naloxone is shorter than the half-life of the buprenorphine. So do you need to put them then on a – if you wanted to maintain that reversal, you have to put them on an infusion, I would imagine, or keep redosing.
At the very minimum, have them in a closely monitored environment and have all that stuff at the bedside ready to go, I would think. Yeah.
Okay.
I haven't run into that situation yet, and we've been using a lot of buprenorphine. The last thing I'd say that is just of interest, people can check this out, that buprenorphine is actually a good reversal agent. So it's multiple studies have shown it's comparable to naloxone to reverse opioid-induced respiratory depression. As for all the other things we worry about with opioids, buprenorphine will be a culprit. Nausea, vomiting, dizziness, headache, probably less pruritus, but otherwise for common adverse effects, you'll see them. And you got to do the preemption just like we would normally do with morphine, hydromorphone, whatever.
Okay, fabulous. So you said that one of the uses is to, you know, treat pain while reducing abuse potential, because this is not a drug that seems to be used in a way that would lead to abuse or to dependence or addiction. But in fact, also is used to treat opioid use disorder. So how are we likely to encounter buprenorphine in our clinical practice? Is it going to be patients who have opioid use disorder and are on buprenorphine for that?
So buprenorphine is the most prescribed medication for opioid use disorder in the U.S. And people out there listening should just realize that this is a disease that's undertreated. So it's good if we see more of our patients on buprenorphine for opioid use disorder. It means they're getting treatment for a life-threatening disease. Most of the studies that look at outcomes in opioid use disorder, mortality, find that if you're treatment with buprenorphine or methadone, it's like a 50% reduction in mentality. Mentality probably goes up.
Absolutely.
And morbidity, of course, all the downstream stuff from good treatment, including like HIV and Hep C, all that stuff decreases too with effective treatment. Sublingual is by far the commonest formulation prescribed for opioid use disorder. And in general, there's a ton of different ways to approach inductions in patients. The literature's all over the place. Most of them, though, are successful, and they all result in basically titrating up buprenorphine until patients feel some normal. The cravings are eliminated. The compulsive use is reduced or eliminated. They get some normal back in their lives. And that usually is about 16 to 32 milligrams. And I think it helps to just think about the CNS and the mu receptor for a second at these big doses. So lead author Greenwald and colleagues did some fascinating studies where they took patients who were maintained on buprenorphine, say a 16 milligram dose, and then 4 hours later they go to a PET scanner, they get injected with tagged carfentanil, which is obviously going to hunt mu receptors, and if they're there, it'll bind them, and they'll light up at the PET scan. So after a 16 milligram dose, it's like over 80% or 80%-ish of mu receptors are occupied, which is what that patient needs to function. We'll talk more about it when we talk about pain, probably next, in terms of how little and tiny the doses are for pain. But that's kind of the background for opioid use disorder treatment.
And I want to make sure I understand what you just described. So they get the dose of buprenorphine, and then the tagged carfentanil is – what role is that playing? What is that doing?
That's just taking that – I mean, I don't know the radiology exactly, but it's taking that isotope or whatever is actually going to show up on the PET scanner, and it's going to grab onto some part of the brain where there's a mu receptor. And that way, when they image the patient, they can see how much of the brain essentially lit up with the carfentanil, well, the tagged carfentanil. And they can make an estimate of the mu receptors that are available. They're neat studies with beautiful pictures of the brain if you're into that kind of thing. And another thing that Greenwald and colleagues did is they correlated like how the patient's feeling to the mu receptor availability / occupancy, their inverse, obviously, and found like, how are you feeling? Are you experiencing cravings? No, I'm not. Well, that's because 80% of your mu receptors are available. Well, maybe at 20%, you're starting to really experience some craving and so on. So that's the study.
So when you say 80% were available, that means that the buprenorphine was preventing binding by the carfentanil to 80% of them.
Yeah, after a 16 milligram dose, 80% were occupied.
By buprenorphine.
By buprenorphine.
Okay.
Unavailable to the carfentanil. Yeah, thank you for clarifying. So it just shows you there's not a big receptor reserve there for us to use other opioids.
Yeah, and so what you're saying is the craving and need for opiate comes from unbound mu receptors, and so if you bind them with buprenorphine, then that you're not going to have that craving. And it sounds like 16 milligrams was enough to reduce that craving.
16 milligrams is usually about where people end up. It's that or more, some less, but that or more, especially in the fentanyl era, where higher doses have been required to get people under control.
Yeah. Okay. Really fascinating. So what about for chronic pain? I think we're seeing more patients on buprenorphine for chronic pain. Is that evidence-based?
The evidence-based in pain is sometimes not the greatest. I think we can acknowledge, and chronic pain is hard to treat. I also think that opioids are not recommended for chronic non-cancer pain. So let's just stipulate that. I think the evidence-based for treating a patient with chronic non-cancer pain with any opioid, including buprenorphine, is not great, right? It could be opposite. All right.
Yeah.
In this setting where, let's face it, patients are still on opioids for chronic pain, buprenorphine is increasingly recommended. So, probably the biggest recommendation I'm aware of, at least, was by lead author Sandbrink. And what they did is say, VA, DOD, you should think about this. It wasn't a super strong recommendation, but it was the first of its kind that said, we recommend considering buprenorphine for patients requiring daily opioids for the management of their chronic pain. Why? For the reasons that we mentioned, less euphorogenic effects and safer from a respiratory depression point of view. So I think in contrast to what I said about the 80% mu receptor occupancy at a OUD type dose, these doses are teeny. So a starting dose in an opioid, naive patient, say, for Belbuca, the buccal formulation, is like 75 micrograms. So divide 32 milligrams by 75 micrograms. It's like potentially in the hundreds of times the dose for opioid use disorder. Buccal, common for this, increasingly common. That was approved in 2015, so it's still kind of in catch-on mode. Transdermal, I think, was approved for chronic pain in 2010, so you may see that too, Butrans. If you see those doses, they're very small. They're most likely for chronic pain management.
And I guess I should have asked, we're talking about buccal, transdermal, so this must not have oral bioavailability. Is that right?
A great question. Yeah, less than 10% oral bioavailability. Yeah,
okay.
Exactly. Sublingual is about 30, buccal is about 55. Transdermals, if you read about it, it's 15, but it's all factored into the 10 mics per hour, 20 mics per hour.
So you're actually getting, when they say 10 mics per hour, that's how much is getting into your intravenous system.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So how about perioperatively? So, this is a huge change since you trained, right, that we're seeing patients come for surgery on buprenorphine. I don't think I saw one patient during my residency on buprenorphine, and now it's not uncommon at all. What is the best current practice for treating patients when they come to us for surgery who are on buprenorphine at home?
This has really been a big change, as the anecdote suggested. So 10 years is not that long in medicine, right? 10 years ago, we were saying you should stop this drug for like 3 days. It was a well-intentioned practice because we were nervous about being able to effectively treat patients' pain. But in practice, what that old dogma did was to create an opioid debt, maybe not withdrawal, out-and-out withdrawal, because we already said it's a milder syndrome. But you're basically creating an opioid debt, let's say, in an opioid tolerant patient who's going under a scalpel. And not only that, you're removing this life-saving medication, which creates a lot of anxiety, not just the patient, but the patient's family and the prescriber. Prescribers didn't like it. And I don't know if you ever remember this scenario, but sometimes we would be asking the prescriber to prescribe like oxycodone for a couple days, which is kind of nuts in retrospect when the patient could have had an oxycodone addiction. So it wasn't great, even though I would just say it was well-intentioned. But thankfully, retrospective data has just started to pile up. A lot of it, say, from obstetrics, where we knew that those women should stay on the buprenorphine throughout their pregnancy. And that data was just showing fairly clearly, even though it was retrospective, that pain outcomes were just better when buprenorphine was continued. So for the patients in whom it was withheld for usually 72 hours, They were just requiring more analgesics and they had worse pain scores. As well as, so you put that retrospective data together with what we know, which is that disruptions in OUD treatment can be really life-threatening. And the perioperative setting is a real risk factor for that. It led to a real paradigm shift over 10 years or so to just continue the bup. Now, you might say, like, if someone's on buprenorphine, is there a dose you'd worry about? Is there, you know, any adjustments that need to be made? And there, the verdict is just not in yet, I think, with prospective data. There are some big healthcare centers. The VA's recommendations include at least contemplating a dose reduction. Last I checked, Mass General Brigham, same thing. And the idea there would be, if you reduce the dose a little, it just gives you a little more flexibility. If you reduce the dose from 24 to, say, 16, maybe now you have some more, you know, opioid receptor reserve that you could treat the way you normally treat pain. I don't think there's a good evidence to support that. But I think the idea being, would you keep enough buprenorphine on board to continue that opioid use disorder treatment, and then you could give some other opioids. Is the right answer to give more buprenorphine? Maybe. We just don't know. I can tell you when I talk to anesthesiologists and surgeons, they're more comfortable with the dose reduction idea. When I talk to addiction medicine audiences, you know, like your sister-in-law, it's like, oh, heck no. Let's not do that.
Yeah, right? Interesting.
So it is kind of interesting. So I hope the easiest thing would be if the prospective trials just say, keep on the usual dose and that's it. That'd be nice to see because it'd be simple for everybody. We just don't know.
Yeah, and this really comes down to the question of, is this a good way of treating acute pain or not, right? If it is, then maybe the more the better. And if not, then maybe we need to reduce the dose and have other options. So what do we think about that? Should we be thinking about buprenorphine as a frontline opiate in our day-to-day anesthesia practice? Is there evidence for that? What do you recommend?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, folks. Hunger strikes and you're exhausted. There's something healthy in your fridge that you should be making, but you just don't have it in you. Sound familiar? For me, eating healthy isn't a willpower problem. It's a setup problem until I found Factor. Factor solves the setup problem with fully prepared meals designed by dietitians and crafted by chefs delivered right to your door. My wife and I want to give our kids healthy food that they will actually eat, but we don't have time to cook from scratch. That's why we use Factor, and you should too. Inside your Factor box, you'll find lean proteins, colorful veggies, whole food ingredients, and healthy fats. It's always fresh, never frozen. My kids think Factor tastes like restaurant food, and honestly, they're right. Over 100 rotating weekly meals, including globally inspired flavors like Mediterranean and Asian, so there's always something new to look forward to. Try the newly launched ready-to-eat salads with vibrant ingredients like elote corn and miso edamame. I wouldn't have believed it until I tried it, and now I can't get enough. Get Factor if you want all the flavor and none of the fuss. Head to factormeals.com/ACRAC50OFF and use code ACRAC50OFF to get 50% off and free daily greens per box. With new subscription only while supplies last until 9/27/26. See website for more details.
Hey folks, this episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Financial stress affects far more than our bank accounts. It can take a serious toll on mental health and relationships. Money worries often bring anxiety, sleep disruption, and even depression, and are one of the leading sources of conflict for couples. It's important to remember that struggling with money doesn't mean you failed. Sometimes it's just about accessing the right kind of support. I've definitely felt overwhelmed at times, especially when I was a resident, trying to figure out how to stretch the dollars farther than they wanted to go. It can be so helpful at those times to get some therapy, not for financial advice, but to manage the stress, shame, or anxiety that can come with financial worries. With over 30,000 therapists who are fully licensed in the U.S., BetterHelp is one of the world's largest online therapy platforms, having served over 6 million people globally. And it works. With an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. BetterHelp does the initial matching work for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. And with 12 plus years of experience and an industry-leading match fulfillment rate, they typically get it right the first time. But if you aren't happy with your match, you can switch to a different therapist at any time. Your emotional well-being matters. When life feels overwhelming, therapy can help. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Hey, folks. I wanted to dive deeper into something that I think can truly make a difference for healthcare workers, FIGS scrubs. Made for awesome humans, these are scrubs that have our needs in mind. They're durable, antimicrobial, and super comfortable, which matters when you're 10 hours into your shift. I love my FIGS, and let me tell you, my wife, a pediatrician, loves hers so much that it's all she wears to work. Ever since COVID, she's all FIGS all the time. It doesn't matter if you're a dentist, a nurse practitioner, a medical student, CRNA, or CRNA student, or an anesthesiologist like me. Investing in a couple of pairs of Figs is totally worth it. We're partnering with Figs to get you 15% off your first purchase when you use code FIGSRX at wearfigs.com. Figs goes beyond scrubs, too. They've got shoes, underscrubs, and even jackets that will make the ever-present hospital AC seem like a thing of the past. And they come in a wide range of colors that will let your personality shine through. Try Figs today by going to wearfigs.com and get 15% off your first order when you enter code FIGSRX at checkout. That's FIGSRX at checkout.
The Fed's out of options. Rate cuts, money printing, balance sheet reversals. They call it policy, but it's really panic. This is in-game economics, where hope replaces discipline and the illusion of control finally breaks. They're not cutting rates because things are strong. They're cutting because the system is cracking. Inflation's eating savings. The labor market's stalling. Confidence in the dollar is fading fast. For decades, the Fed built a house of paper. Now they're striking the match that could burn it all down, leaving you to pay the price. When's the last time you actually held the wealth you've spent your life working for? My friends at Noble Gold Investments have been helping Americans move from paper wealth into real tangible assets. Numbers on a screen can disappear, but physical gold and silver, they've outlasted every crisis in history. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and get your free wealth protection kit today. That's NobleGoldInvestments.com for your free wealth protection kit. Discover how simple it is to protect your future.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
All right, and we're back.
Yeah, I think there's good evidence to support this for acute pain management. If that's what you mean. Patients, you know, coming to your operating room for knee replacement, opioid naive, should we be thinking about buprenorphine? I'd say yes. So I just would stipulate for the audience that, again, despite our best efforts, we're still reaching for a lot of opioids. You probably know this literature as well as I do. Patients come in for inpatient surgery, over 90% are getting opioids. Discharge after common surgery, 50% are getting discharged with opioids. A significant number, most studies say around 6% are taking them 6 months later.
Yep.
With significant harms to the system, to the patient, to the family, et cetera. So, like I kind of said at the onset, I was reading all these old studies. I mean, some of them really old, with pentazocine being compared, you know, to buprenorphine. So some old studies. And every time I looked at them, I'd say, dang, buprenorphine's doing good. Like, it looks impressive. And along came a systematic review meta-analysis in BJA 2018 by lead author White. And what they did is compared buprenorphine just to morphine. It was acute pain in a hospital setting, but not all adult. Some of it was like renal colic, ED kind of thing, so not all perioperative. And their big conclusion was that buprenorphine was just as good as morphine, the granddaddy of opioids for acute pain management, but they didn't really put a lot of highlight on a p-value that was 0.07. And I was like, dang, that's interesting, right? So what I did was put together a team that really does this kind of thing, because I hadn't, and we did a meta-analysis that we published in Wrapham earlier this year, and that looked at any study through time that looked at buprenorphine versus any comparator opioid, just in adults. I don't do peds, the VA, and only perioperative, so kind of our patients, really, and an anesthesiologist patients. And for the pain intensity outcome, we had almost 2,600 participants, so their data contributed to that, and it showed buprenorphine significantly reduced pain intensity. The odds ratio for needing rescue analgesia was statistically significantly reduced. The duration of analgesia was 8.5 hours, and the average dose was about 750 micrograms, sublingual equivalent, which would be like 0.2 like 200 mics IV or so, something in that ballpark. No significant difference in any other adverse effects. And, you know, just to show the audience, it's not completely crazy hickey idea. Nisora put out a coverage of it pretty quickly. And their quote was, should be considered as a first line opioid analgesic for acute postoperative pain. Its use may reduce opioid related harm. I think it's going to get some press and pain medicine news soon and anesthesiology news. So it's out there. I should mention regional. You know, there's a ton of papers, a shocking number of papers that have looked at it as an adjunct in regional to local anesthetic. And I'll just quote from Vitor, who is lead author of a big review in 2023, which just said buprenorphine has the most robust scientific efficacy. So it's out there. Basically the idea would be it just has more of a prolongation of the sensory block than really any other opioid. No big surprise, because it's a long duration. If you compare it to like Precedex, you get kind of a similar prolongation of duration. And guess what? More people in the buprenorphine group throw up because it's an opioid and the other one's not.
Right.
But that's kind of the idea with it. We've really started to establish a program.
Hey, folks, before we hear about that program, I just wanted to take a second and give a shout out to our rockstar returning sponsor, TrueLearn Smart Banks. I've used TrueLearn for my residence for years, and it is hands down the best smart bank out there. The questions are excellent, and the answers have clear explanations that break down why each choice is correct or incorrect. And now you can create flashcards, which are a key tool for high-quality studying and maximizing test performance. The education research is clear that spaced repetition with these kind of tools is the best way to learn and retain information. We use their ITE, basic, and advanced smart banks for our residents, each with 1,000-plus questions, realistic visuals and graphs, and even a calculator that mimics what they have on the actual exam. Our residents love it and get great results. TrueLearn even has a CME smart bank where you can get AMA, PRA, Category 1 credits after you finish training, and an adult cardiac anesthesiology smart bank as well. Go to TrueLearn.com and use code ACRAC to get $25 off residency exams, USMLE, and Comlex smart bank subscriptions of 90 days or longer, and up to 20% off other healthcare exam subscriptions. We rely on TrueLearn for our test prep, and I highly recommend you do the same. TrueLearn.com and use code ACRAC. All right, and now let's get back to that plan for how to incorporate buprenorphine.
I think the first step, if you're thinking about using buprenorphine, is to think, well, does my patient need it? And if a patient's not going to need opioids, it doesn't make any sense to use buprenorphine. But if you think they're going to need opioids after surgery, either because of surgical factors, patient factors, you can consider it. Obviously, multimodal too, obviously, antiemesis like you normally would, not only because it's an opioid, but you want your first repetitions with anything new to be kind of reassuring to you and reassuring to the patient, reassuring to the PACU. If you have IV, as we said, we kind of are IV type people. So the recommended dose for acute pain management per the label is 300 micrograms. We got it. The VA added buprenorphine to the national formulary in April of last year, and we got pretty easily got IV buprenorphine on our shelves, and it comes in a pretty handy 300 mic per cc unit dose. In my practice, if I think a patient's old or frail, I'll just give half of that. A little bit can go a long way. But in general, I'd say, you know, I give it pre-op, once kind of green light to take the patient back to the room, give half of it. It's recommended to give as a slow bolus, so whatever that means, over a minute or two. And then maybe when we get into the operating room, give the other 150 mics. If you're relying on the opioid to really keep the blood pressure below 200 as you're doing the nasty laryngoscopy intubation, you might not have it all there. It might not be really achieving that purpose exactly, Jed, because that's the reason a lot of us give opioids. So you might want to have some Esmol handy if you're really worried about that. In PACU, our order sets have 300 mics IV. They have 150 mics if you're kind of worried about frailty or elderly patient. If you don't have IV and prefer buccal, we really kind of pioneered a buccal pathway because we just didn't have IV. So it kind of necessitated an alternate formulation. And there's a lot of doses. It's a nice thing about the buccal. We went with 450 because, like we said, with bioavailability, it's about the same as the 300 mic IV dose. You could err toward lower dose, say 300 mics in elderly frail patients. You can redose it in PACU. You can give it early in the anesthetic. Basically, all a patient needs is some moist mucosa. Just tell them, just stick it on and leave it. My old chief here gave a lot of buccal buprenorphine to thoracic patients. That was kind of one of the first populations we started to use it in. And he was sometimes putting it in position laterally, double loop, big ass double lumen tube, you know, still stick it on there. Some of the first adopters, really the first believers, were actually the PACU nurses because they were seeing such a difference. Transdermal, there's some real advocates out there for transdermal. I've never used it for this purpose, but you kind of can see that if your patient is knee replacement, thoracic surgery, kind of patient is going to probably be taking around the clock opioids for at least a few days. It's a week long patch. So it's designed to last a week. So I think establishing a program with your surgeons, with your pharmacy is a good idea, especially if it's off label use like it would be for the buccal. We went with a twice daily inpatient dosing for these thoracic patients and knee replacements. For pragmatic reasons, we just said, surgeon, do whatever the heck you want in the background. Your usual order set, just go ahead. And we'll just order this buccal buprenorphine. And we published results of some retrospective cohorts, and it's all retrospective, so take it for what it's worth. But in general, there was a signal that there was a decrease in opioids and pain in the buprenorphine-treated group. The VA has since published national guidelines recommending buprenorphine, at least consideration of buprenorphine for acute pain management, including these alternate formulations. So since that, it's clinical judgment. We can use buprenorphine in any patient we think would benefit from it. And we've had some patients go through the whole perioperative period after knee replacement, thoracic surgery, where that's it. No oxycodone, no fentanyl, no hydromorphone. And they go home on a little reduced dose of buccal buprenorphine, like 300 mics twice daily, PRN.
So very interesting.
And you can, the listener can ask Google that national guideline from the VA will pop right up. So I'd love to talk more about this. This is kind of the center of my passion project with the buprenorphine, but that's kind of the overview of what we've been doing.
Yeah, very cool. So, you know, this reminds me a lot of methadone. I'm a big methadone fan for perioperative use, and it is often referred to as an opioid-sparing opioid, right? And I think this is what sounds like you're the way you're using buprenorphine as well. It's, any thought on the, I doubt there's a study, comparing them head to head, but any thought on methadone versus buprenorphine for acute pain management perioperatively?
Great question. I love this question. It'd be like a heavyweight fight to see the two paired up. The only thing I could find was like a poster from like the 70s that compared them. I'll send it to you after. You'll like it. It's like a, I don't think it ever turned into a full manuscript, but buprenorphine won that round one of that.
Interesting.
Now, instead of doing like a pro con, I mean, I think both is the answer. I like methadone for all the reasons you describe. I think where buprenorphine shines, and we had Evan Karish from Duke come give a grand rounds. I thought it was super compelling.
Yep.
I love his work. I think that I buy into this opioid sparing opioid idea. But let's say, you know, Jed Wopaw wants to create a program in methadone at your institution and you want to continue it. You want to give it that second dose? Well, okay. All right. And pack you 2.5 milligrams or so. Nobody's going to be breathing down your neck. And now you say, well, let's give another dose on the floor. Oh, let's do another. Is it going to happen? I doubt it.
No.
Because people have concerns about methadone safety, the variable pharmacology, metabolism, the dose stacking, the full agonist stuff, the QTC, which I know you and I could be quite comfortable. It's not going to be a problem for a lot of good reason. But still, there'll be a lot of other people who think it's a problem who would probably interfere with your plans. So I think that's where buprenorphine shines, is that you get a lot of the same opioid-sparing opioid effect, largely just because it's long duration. But then you can continue it. So you can keep your lead, you know, to use a sports metaphor, keep your lead. And hopefully you get some of that long-term opioid-sparing effect you see with methadone. But if a patient needs to go home with opioids for a while, they can go home with buprenorphine. I just think that's kind of from a pragmatic standpoint, where buprenorphine would shine in that contest. That said, I think methadone's great. I love it when the residents come over and are pumped to give patients methadone. It's a kind of off topic here when we're talking about buprenorphine, but I love Karish's paper on like the dose finding for ambulatory surgery, and I just kind of adhere to that.
Yep.
You know, 10, 20 milligrams, you know, a little bit more in emergence, maybe a little bit more in PACU, and man, they sail, right?
Absolutely.
They
sail.
They do a great, and I think you'd see the same, honestly, if you try buprenorphine on for size.
Yeah, I love that. I love the idea of a single dose of methadone with induction and then PACU and even Floren maybe home with buprenorphine. That sounds like it could be the perfect combination.
It's an interesting idea. Yeah. A lot of opportunities for research here for the listeners.
I can't wait. Fabulous. All right. Well, you know, we commonly take care of patients who are already on opioids that are not buprenorphine, right? So patients come in on oxycodone or maybe methadone that they take at home for maybe opioid use disorder. How does buprenorphine fit in for those patients?
Yeah, great question. Common clinical scenario. You know, these patients are difficult. And I think the first step is just saying these patients are difficult. They're probably going to be difficult. They might surprise you, but some degree of tolerance is almost by definition. Some degree of hyperalgesia, we're not exactly sure how clinically relevant that is, but it probably plays some small role. Some degree of dependence. So if they stop taking the opioid or we don't know they're on the opioid, withdrawal often hurts. Like it experiences pain. Then you take a patient with a history of addiction. Maybe they're on methadone or buprenorphine for that. That adds another layer of complexity to management. Guess what? They usually have comorbid chronic pain. Guess what? They usually have anxiety. They maybe mood disorder, maybe insomnia. All these things, if you look at the best paper you're aware of for risk factors for poorly controlled pain, it's like ding, 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 ding. So it's challenging. So I think you tell yourself that and you'd feel a little bit better about the situation, I think. Unfortunately, there's just cruddy evidence to go by, cruddy high-level evidence. I was lucky to be part of a team, lead author Bonara, Annals of Internal Medicine, 2025 review that looked at just pain management strategies, did another similar paper that was published shortly thereafter. And man, there's just, you find like some small study from Iran looking at like some odd medicine intrathecally. And there's some, and it's like, come on, it's just, there's just not a lot out there to support any particular intervention or another. So what do? Kitchen sink. I mean, it's probably the same as you would do. Give them the kitchen sink and hope for the best. So that's expectation setting up front. Regional, if you can do it. I mean, regional is really a secret weapon for these cases. If you can do it, maybe continuous regional. One thing that I think a pain service would deliver is comfort with just aggressively titrating opioids. You just got to remember, they're going to get their baseline. It's not going to do anything for their pain. Then it's some studies, 20% more, 30% more, 50% more, 100% more. You just kind of don't know. As long as you're doing all the adjuncts already, what else do you got? I mean, you're just going to titrate opioids aggressively. Obviously, multimodal analgesia. I think non-pharmacologic stuff is something that we usually fall short on, honestly, as anesthesiologists, and we could do better. So if you really have a pain service, especially a multidisciplinary one, even just the cryotherapy, TENS, PT, distraction techniques, a lot of we did a paper on pharmacological and non-pharmacological interventions. Let me tell you, most of the studies going on now are non-pharmacological. It's like yoga and stuff like that. I think a lot of people, there might be some eye rolling, but hey, that's powerful stuff. Distraction from your pain is powerful stuff. As well as just getting on your feet after surgery. And multidisciplinary team, if you can at all do it, if that's present in your hospital and your setting, do it. I think for the patients who are on methadone or buprenorphine, I mean, we kind of already touched on the main theme, the lowest hanging fruit, keep it going, keep the methadone going, take the whole dose on the day of, splitting the dose, meaning if you're on 24 milligrams of buprenorphine, splitting it into 888. There's some people that promote that. Maybe a part of it's just giving patient more. You say, here's another pain med. I don't know. There's a little bit of a difference opinion on whether that really improves outcomes, but it is something you could consider. Giving one while on the other, you kind of mentioned that a little bit when you're just thinking about like a pain study in opioid naive patients. I don't really know where that fits in. I haven't seen much on that. Discharge planning is key in those patients. You really got to link them up. Probably usually an anesthesia thing, but they, if you're on a transitional pain service or something, that's key, obviously, to get them in touch with their prescriber. You might call it a reach goal for somebody out there who's motivated. You know, smoking cessation, there's some literature when people come in, they're motivated, man. They want that knee replaced. They've been thinking about it for years. They lost 10 pounds for it. You know, they stopped drinking six pack. Now it's a couple of beers a night, whatever. They're making this progress. It might be an opportunity for that patient who has untreated OUD, who has problematic prescription opioid use. Maybe this is a time you could actually rotate a patient to bup. Now, I think your average person out there is like, Jesus, I got enough on my plate, man. Hickey, shut up. They're like, we got enough going on. And it's obviously not the couch at home. There's physiologic challenges, psychologic challenges, pharmacologic challenges going on. It's a more complicated milieu, but I'll say it's an interesting opportunity And I think what might make people believers is that you just see pain outcomes might be better and longer term outcomes like pain interference, function, all that stuff might be better if you're on buprenorphine as opposed to some of these other opioids.
Interesting. So My question is, you mentioned earlier that buprenorphine might even be an effective reversal agent for opioid overdose. So is there any danger in a patient, let's say, who's on just a huge amount of opiate at home, who comes in, they took their most recent dose in pre-op, you know, they've got it all on board. If you give them, let's say you're a fan of doing, your plan is, I'm going to do buprenorphine as my primary analgesic. If you give them a big dose of buprenorphine, is there any risk of reversing the opiates they already have on board?
I think it's a great question. And I do think there's some risk. Let's say the bad scenario would be patient comes in, you come in and you just tell me, no, I don't take any opioids, but turns out you take like 200 MME a day. And then I give you buprenorphine. Now I doubt it would have a big impact, Jed, because we're talking about 300 micrograms. But if I'm sure in that scenario, if I gave you a 12 milligram sublingual or 16 milligram, then yeah, you'd probably be hurting. I think what we've learned from opioid use disorder treatment when it comes to this precipitation of withdrawal, it's a question I get a lot, is that those patients are taking astronomical fentanyl doses, just unbelievable fentanyl doses. And they come into an ED setting, and ED is really led on this, rotations to buprenorphine. And they give them big doses of buprenorphine, often just right away. It's not the old school traditional induction where you wait until the patient's in withdrawal, you start with teeny dose, you titrate up over time. These ED docs are just going big. They're like, here's 12 milligrams. Here's another, you know, just keep going. And they do well in that scenario. So could you conceivably? Yes, you could. I think it's probably not what I probably wouldn't reach for buprenorphine in that patient who's on high dose opioids at home, unless we really had a thoughtful approach to really rotate to it. When in the perioperative care, I don't know. It's a really interesting topic. I think we should explore it as a field. But yeah, theoretically there'd be that risk. But I do think what I mentioned from opioid use disorder experience is that the likelihood of it happening at a 450 mic buckle dose or 300 mic buckle dose or one of these small IV doses would be pretty darn small.
Okay. Well, that's great to know. So I think much like methadone, there are a lot of misconceptions or even myths out there about buprenorphine. I know there are a lot about methadone. I try to address them all the time. But let's address some of them. You brought some of them up already, but maybe just to kind of bring them all into one place. What are some common misconceptions about buprenorphine that may be preventing people from wanting to use it, and how can we try to set them straight?
Yeah, great question. I think methadone is a really apt comparison here. I think in particular, buprenorphine may even be a little bit worse in anesthesiologists because you had generations who basically trained to be in fear of the drug. Right? I mean, that's kind of the nature of our old practice, was really to be kind of in fear of the drug. So when we hear Suboxone, we kind of, a little shiver goes down our spine. So there's that. So there's certainly a knowledge gap that needs to be made up. But as far as sort of myths to bust, the partial agonist one comes up. Like if I'm taking care of you and pack you and I say, well, I got a partial pain medicine or a full, you know, you're going to be pretty sure which one you want. Yeah. But we know from buprenorphine that's not partial analgesia, right? It's not partial analgesia. It's very full in that effect. And actually, most of what comes downstream of the mu receptor, you want to be partial, as we said. So there's that myth. I don't think that historical categorization has really helped the drug. Ceiling effect. So I think that came up a couple times, but people say, well, there's a ceiling effect for analgesia, right? And, you know, I would point to another Dehan paper. I mentioned him earlier in the context of respiratory depression, but he had a BJA paper also 2006. And the title was Buprenorphine Induces Ceiling and Respiratory Depression, but Not in Analgesia. So the title kind of says it all across the doses they studied, which is up to, I think, twice the recommended IV pain dose. So I don't think ceiling effect for analgesia is something we should be concerned about. I often get this idea, well, if we're giving buprenorphine, can we give other opioids? So that's kind of a little myth to bust. The answer is sure, you can. You could also get more buprenorphine. Again, when we talked about this kind of esoteric topic of the mu receptor availability, I just bring that up as sort of a conceptual framework that if I'm occupying 10% of Jed Wolpaw's mu receptors, I mean, that means there's 90% still there, like available. So giving oxycodone on top of some buprenorphine is fine. We don't really know. I think some good experimental trials would be really neat to see whether there's an additive effect when you combine buprenorphine with usual care opioids. So that's another one. We talked about precipitation of withdrawal comes up a lot. Do we need to taper? That's one that comes up. Surgeons in particular ask that because we're not in the usual practice of discharging patients home on oxycodone. I think based on what we know about the withdrawal syndrome being pretty mild, as well as being long acting and kind of auto tapering, this wouldn't be a problem. And often I'll just ask the audience when this question comes up, like, what do you do with oxycodone? Do you tape? Are you tapering oxycodone routinely? I think the answer would be, what are you talking about? No.
Right.
Well, there you go. Needing IV for pain. I think some people just think, well, acute pain, man, we need IV medications. And really, buprenorphine compares surprisingly well across the number of post-op pain, but also ED. We're talking renal colic, breakthrough cancer pain, bone fractures, so emergency medicine type pain. And sublingual buprenorphine compares, it's most studies just say, as basically equivalent pain outcomes when you're just putting a milligram sublingual bup under the tongue compared to IM or IV method morphine, which I think is counterintuitive in our brains, but that's what the studies show. And part of it's that lipophilicity and some of those pharmacological features.
Very cool. All right. Well, those are all really important things to address. And if people have those concerns, oh, I can't use this because there's only so much analgesia I can get, right? Good to put that to rest. Let's talk about future erections. This is an exciting medication. We're using it in new ways. It's got a lot of benefits that you've gone over. What do you see as big next steps for buprenorphine, where we might use it, how we might use it? What's going to come down the road?
I think a big contemporary study with contemporary drugs within a multimodal analgesia pathway, looking at usual care, opioids versus buprenorphine. And then I think you're obligated to look at the pain intensity in PACU, pain intensity on the floor, opioid consumption. But I think the money shot is 3 months later, 6 months later. That's where I would theorize, based on what we know, just theory, that if 6% of patients are still taking oxycodone 6 months after their surgery, what would it be with buprenorphine based on everything we know? What if it's 5? Well, that's big. What if it's 4? That's bigger. So I think there'd be a reduction in patients who are on opioids. Would some of the patients be on buprenorphine 6 months later? Yes. I think we could stipulate that that will be a thing that happens. But would there be a reduction in persistent post-op opioid use? I think that's reasonable. I think that's very reasonable. And that's, you'd have to accompany that with some of those sophisticated pain interference, satisfaction, which is kind of an amalgam pain score that we should think probably more about as a profession. I think those outcomes is what we really need when it comes to buprenorphine. Next steps, the lowest hanging fruit, as we've said, is to continue the bup. And there's still a lot of practice variation across the country on this. Yeah. Believe it or not. I think your setting, ICU, I've been in touch with some intensivists over at Yale trying to get in their head about thinking about buprenorphine in the ICU setting. I think based on the safety features, the respiratory component, the long duration, I think it's just an interesting thing to integrate into some ICU pain management. And people hurt in the ICU. There's a lot of pain in the ICU. There's also a lot of procedures that hurt and so on. Trauma, similarly, when I've looked at trauma recently, boy, all the post-op opioid stuff, is worse. I mean, you know this because that's part of your business. It's not part of my usual business. But trauma, opioid outcomes and pain outcomes are worse than just straight surgery, partly because a lot of them get surgery. So that's interesting. I think emergency medicine is another interesting frontier for this. And there's some people at Stanford, I'll shout them out, Jonathan Lee, Terry Ahern, have published a number of interesting papers from Stanford where they're using really small IV doses of buprenorphine. We're talking like 100 mics. And they're getting really good pain outcomes in typical garden variety emergency medicine encounters. DOD, so anybody from DOD listening, you can figure my email address, call me. I think this idea, if the listeners have never opened one of these buccal buprenorphine, it's like a scope patch. It's like a scope patch, basically, if you think about it. We've all used scope patches, right? It's almost the same size. It's the same container. Every frontline medic has scissors. That's it. You don't need a needle. You don't need glass. You don't need a refrigerator. You could put hundreds, you wouldn't need them, but you could put 100 of these in your pocket and you wouldn't even notice it. So, and then to have something that causes less respiratory depression, probably less cognitive impairment, and lasts 8.5 hours, is compatible with everything else they're using, which is basically NSAID, acetaminophen, maybe ketamine. And then morphine historically was the other battlefield analgesic. I think it's kind of a cool to think about how it might fit into that scenario. I mean, there's some stuff that I mentioned only because if you're trying to make a case to surgeons on this, they might be more in tune to this, which is that there's some immunological stuff that's fascinating about it. Most of this comes from animal studies, but if I injure mice and then I give them buprenorphine versus like placebo, the healing's better, the buprenorphine group. It's like, really? That doesn't make any sense. So that stuff is, of course, mice. I don't take that study too seriously, but it's something you could get some interest in certain audiences if you think about maybe there'd be some wound healing benefits for buprenorphine versus usual care opioids. That's super stretch. So I don't want to go too hard into that category.
Interesting.
I think that's the stuff. That's the stuff I'm kind of keen to see.
Very cool. Well, Tom, this has been such an interesting talk, and I learned a ton. I just think this is going to be really interesting to see where it goes, and hopefully more people will start using this. It sounds like there's just so many great uses in our world for it. So exciting to see what comes down the road. Let's turn to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. What would you recommend the audience check out for fun?
I got an author recommendation, a book author recommendation. You know the name Peter Heller?
It sounds familiar.
So this guy, Peter Heller, writes really interesting books where there's a lot of outdoors, also just interesting characters. And the plots are kind of all over there. Like there's, you know, a couple of high school buddies that just always do an annual canoe trip, and all of a sudden the forest is on fire and there's murder everywhere and stuff like that. There's some post-apocalyptic ones. The one I'm reading now is called The Orchard, but I think I'd recommend Dog Stars. So if somebody wants to start into the Peter Heller world, I think like Cormac McCarthy launched me into Peter Heller. So if you have an affinity for one, you probably have an affinity for this one. Dog Stars is freaking awesome. Check out Dog Stars first, the Dog Stars, Peter Heller. You should do it.
Very cool. I love new books and authors, so I will put it on the list. I am going to recommend, I'm sure people know the author, Michael Pollan, and he has a new book out called A World Appears, A Journey into Consciousness. Now, I haven't read the book yet, but I listened to Ezra Klein's interview with Michael Pollan about the book, and it's really interesting. So if you don't want to read the whole book, listen to the interview. I just find this so fascinating, this idea that consciousness is something we don't really understand, and maybe it's in our brain, or maybe our brain is just a receiver for something that's out there and it's filtering it. And, you know, there's just so many interesting theories and ways to think about this. And if you've read other things by Michael Pollan, his previous book was about psychedelics. And so that also plays a role here in thinking about how psychedelics help elucidate the role and meaning of consciousness. So really interesting. And you can get a taste for it in Ezra Klein's interview with him. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. All right, Tom, this has been great. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Pleasure's all mine.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrack.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at ACRAC Podcast, and you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/ACRAC. That's patreon.com/ACRAC, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/ACRAC or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Sonia Amanat is our tech lead. Taylor Duggan, William Mao, and Rachel Furman are our production assistants and social media managers. Thanks so much for all you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right, that is it for today. For the ACRAC podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.